70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
Xin chào, tôi tên là Trang, một thính giả thường xuyên theo dõi KBS World Radio. Tôi được biết tới KBS World Radio từ khi còn là sinh viên đại học.
Hi, my name is Trang. I'm a KBS World Radio listener from Vietnam. I learned about the channel when I came to college. The news section of the KBS World Radio website was very helpful when I took a Korean translation class because the professor quoted a lot from there. The KBS World Radio news indeed deepened my understanding of Korean society and its people. Ever since, listening to KBS World Radio has become my daily routine. I don't only listen to news, but also K-pop programs and Korea Today and Tomorrow to learn more about Korea. It's now been 15 years already. Congratulations on the 70th anniversary. I wish you all the best and hope you continue to bring lots of interesting stories from Korea.
Ngày càng phát triển hơn nữa, ngày càng mang tới cho các thính giả quốc tế như tôi những nguồn tin tức cập nhật liên tục và đa dạng về nhiều lĩnh vực khác nhau. Xin cảm ơn KBS World Radio.
70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it's Monday, the 22nd of May, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. On the sidelines of the G7 summit over the weekend, President Yoon Suk-yeol and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida visited a memorial honoring the Korean victims of the Hiroshima atomic bombing. Meanwhile, President Yoon also met with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky, where he promised more non-lethal aid to the war-torn country. We'll have more details on news briefing shortly, and we'll also discuss the outcomes from the busy diplomatic weekend for our in-depth today. And coming up for Monday's sports roundup, we find out the latest on the detention of footballer Son Jun-ho in China. Let's begin Korea 24. Sounds of camera shutters rang through the air at Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park on Sunday as President Yoon Suk-yeol and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida observed a moment of silence and laid flowers in front of a cenotaph commemorating over 30,000 Koreans who lost their lives in the 1945 Hiroshima atomic bombing during World War II. The two leaders then sat down for their third summit meeting in 2 months on the margins of the Group of Seven summit, reflecting on the significance of the memorial visit and improved bilateral ties. Let's listen to some comments made by President Yoon, followed by Prime Minister Kishida.
This was the first time the leaders of the two countries paid tribute to the Korean victims of the 1945 atomic bombing together. And this is also the first time a South Korean president visited the monument. Our visit together is not only about paying tribute, but it will also be remembered as a courageous act by Prime Minister Kishida to prepare for a peaceful future.
Earlier, I was able to offer my prayers with you and your wife to the Korean atomic bomb victims' memorial monument together. I feel that this was very important in terms of the relationship between Japan and South Korea and in praying for world peace.
For more on this story and our other headlines from today, I'm joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Daniel Che. Daniel, hello.
Hello there, Jang-woo.
So it seems the two leaders continue to work to normalize and improve bilateral ties and expand cooperation. Can you tell us more about what took place over the weekend.
Yes, it was the first time the two countries' leaders jointly paying tribute at Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park on Sunday for the signs of efforts to improve ties, to maintain momentum and move forward together. Some of the surviving victims and descendants were invited to the historic event as well. Following that, during their 35-minute conversation, the leaders reaffirmed the need for Seoul, Washington and Tokyo to coordinate policies against Pyongyang's missile threats, agreeing to continue shuttle diplomacy, ensuring frequent summits through reciprocal visits between Korea and Japan. There was no particular mention of colonial-era issues or a South Korean expert team conducting an inspection this week of Tokyo's ongoing preparation to release radioactive water from Fukushima nuclear power plant. Yun and Kishida have chosen to focus on shared challenges first rather than wait for contentious historical disputes to be resolved. The leaders also held a three-way meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden, where they agreed to further advance trilateral security coordination to include supply chains and other global issues and to enhance their security cooperation to reinforce deterrence. U.S. media reported that Biden invited Yun and Kishida to Washington for another trilateral meeting. Strong trilateral alliance could reshape the security landscape in Northeast Asia in the face of China's assertive behavior and North Korea's expanding nuclear arsenal.
Meanwhile, there was a surprise visit by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to the G7 summit. He met with various leaders, including President Yoon Suk-yeol, who promised to provide demining equipment and medical evacuation vehicles to Ukraine. Can you tell us more?
Yoon sat down with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for about half an hour on Sunday on the sidelines of the G7 summit in Hiroshima. During a joint news conference in Seoul with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz later in the day, Yoon confirmed his plans.
There have been many civilian casualties due to Russian landmines, which they buried during their withdrawals. Ukraine is requesting demining equipment and medical evacuation vehicles. We will review the request and send this aid as soon as possible. President Zelensky has given us a list of non-lethal aid. We will also carefully review this.
So the list is said to include demining vehicles and armored ambulances as well as air defense radars. Sources noted Seoul is considering sending K-600 armored vehicles that can carve out pathways through minefields using plows attached to the front as well as PRS-20K mine detectors. Mines remain in many fields in Ukraine, making it perilous for farmers to sow grain, and some even got impatient. They even designed a remote-controlled tractor that could withstand blasts using armor from damaged Russian military vehicles. That shows just how much in dire need they are of expertise in terms of mine removal. Back in March, a senior official from the Cambodian Mine Action and Victim Assistance Authority thanked the Korean government for its humanitarian mine action work, saying it saved lives and alleviated poverty. So South Korea is no novice when it comes to providing support for mine removal and demining activities. During an expanded session of the G7 summit, Yoon also denounced Russia's war in Ukraine, arguing that the situation in Ukraine and North Korea serve as reminders that freedom and peace can be guarded only when international regulations and the rule of law are upheld. In a post on Twitter after the summit, Zelensky said he thanked Yoon for the non-lethal aid, particularly demining vehicles. Last week, First Lady Olena Zelenska visited Seoul as a presidential special envoy to Seoul and requested that Yoon send non-lethal military hardware to Ukraine. Yoon and Zelensky reached an agreement at their meeting in Hiroshima regarding South Korea's participation in Ukraine's reconstruction as well.
The G7 leaders also addressed North Korea's provocations. They condemned the launch of ballistic missiles at an unprecedented frequency by the regime as a violation of UN Security Council resolutions.
That's right. In a joint statement issued during the G7 summit in Hiroshima on Saturday, the leaders of the world's most powerful democracies vowed to strongly respond to further provocations by the regime. The statement called on North Korea to refrain from nuclear tests or missile launches, warning that reckless action will be met by swift, united and resolute global response. They expressed concerns that Pyongyang prioritizes WMD development over its people and urged the regime to respond to proposals for dialogue, respect human rights, allow access by global human rights organizations, and promptly resolve the issue of Japanese abductees. The G7 leaders also denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine and pledged unwavering support for Kyiv, also addressed China, conveying the group's readiness to seek constructive, stable relations, but warning any attempt to forcibly change the status quo will not be tolerated, urging Beijing to peacefully resolve the issue in the Taiwan Strait.
Let's get the latest now on the South Korean team inspecting Tokyo's planned release of radioactive wastewater from the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant. They got to work on Monday, I understand. Can you tell us more?
Right. According to related governmental task force, the 21-member team held a technical meeting and Q&A session with Japan's related institutions, including Tokyo Electric Power Company, the Japanese Industry Ministry, and the Nuclear Regulation Authority. From Tuesday, they will conduct a two-day review of Tokyo's management of wastewater from the Fukushima Unit 1 reactor of the nuclear plant, then an in-depth technical meeting and Q&A session with the Japanese side based on an on-site inspection on Thursday. The team led by Nuclear Safety and Security Commission Chairperson Yuko Ki comprises experts on nuclear facilities, radiation, and the marine environment from the Korea Institute of Nuclear Safety and the Korea Institute of Ocean Science and Technology. And speaking to reporters before a meeting with TEPCO, Japanese officials on Monday, Yu said his team will first check the K4 tanks, which measures the concentration of radioactive substances in the contaminated water before discharge. They will also inspect the plant's custom purification system, the ELPS, Advanced Liquid Processing System, which is the most important aspect in the removal of several types of radioactive materials from contaminated water. You emphasize the team will inspect in detail, continue to review for safety, and ensure that the inspection is substantial and sufficiently carried out. The crippled Fukushima plant stores over 1.3 million tons of water treated by the ELPS, which is set to be released beginning this summer and may take decades to complete.
And finally, the Democratic Party member turned independent lawmaker Yoon Gwan-seok appeared for questioning by the prosecution on Monday as a suspect in an illicit political fund scandal involving a number of his former party members. Can you tell us more?
Well, the question of Yoon on charges of violating the Political Parties Act comes 3 days after prosecutors grill a fellow DP turned independent Yi Sung-man on the same charges. Yoon is suspected of colluding with Yi and Kang Nae-gu, a former standing auditor of the Korea Water Resources Corporation, to deliver 60 million won, or $45,000, to sitting lawmakers ahead of the 2021 party convention to secure the leadership victory of Song Yeong-gil, the three-term lawmaker who left the DP amid the allegations, flatly denied playing such a role. If Yoon continued to deny the allegations, prosecutors may decide to seek an arrest warrant, which would require parliamentary approval.
We'll wrap it up there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you so much for having me.
In a joint statement issued over the weekend, the leaders of the world's most powerful democracies denounced in the strongest terms Russia's invasion of Ukraine and pledged unwavering support for Kyiv. On China, the G7 leaders said they are ready to seek constructive, stable relations, but warned that any attempt to forcibly change the status quo will not be tolerated. And they vowed to sternly respond to any further provocations by North Korea. Meanwhile, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol attended the summit as a guest nation. While he was there, he held various summit talks and meetings on the sidelines with leaders including Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. For a breakdown of the weekend's events, we have two guests joining us on the line now. First, we have international relations expert Professor Robert Kelly from Busan National University. Professor Kelly, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. Nice to be on again.
And we also have Brad Glosserman, the Deputy Director and Visiting Professor at the Center for Rulemaking Strategies at Tama University in Japan. Professor, hello to you too.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you both for your time today. First off, can I get your overall assessments of this year's G7 summit, starting with you, Professor Kelly? What were your main takeaways?
I think you touched on it there at the start, right? I mean, the real big issues were Ukraine and ensuring that there was enough cooperation on Ukraine to make sure that Ukraine is supported beyond just the coming counteroffensive over the summer, that we're starting to think beyond just sort of, you know, one arms shipment after another. And we're starting to think in terms of, a longer support. The war will probably not end this year. Ukraine will probably need support for at least a couple of years until the Russians tire, I think. And that's when they'll come to the table in like a couple of years. And then after that, of course, Ukraine's going to need reconstruction assistance. There were debates about Ukraine coming into the European Union or maybe even NATO. And so it's good that all of these big wealthy states who are, you know, sort of broadly a part of the coalition behind Ukraine are actually starting to think about this stuff rather than, you know, just sort of like from one arms shipment to another, the sort of very short-term thinking that's been the way so far.
Mm, so perhaps long-term coordination on Ukraine. Professor Glossman, what stood out for you from the G7 summit?
It's relevant. I mean, to be very honest, for the
it's
last
irrelevant,
decade or
you
so,
say, sorry, Professor Glossman?
It's relevant, not irrelevant, relevant.
Relevance, right.
For the last decade or so, the G7 to me has flirted with kind of irrelevance, as you put it. It's kind of been a whiff of nostalgia, right, of the old boys club that used to run the world trying to feel as though they still have a purpose. I think in the aftermath of the global financial crisis in 2007, 8, and 9, you know, there was a sense that it had been eclipsed by the G20, and they were looking for a purpose because economic management had fallen to a larger, more diverse group. And I think Ukraine, quite frankly, has given the G7 a new sense of purpose to sort of rally in defense of a global order and provide political direction. And this meeting seemed genuinely to do that. And it's not just Ukraine, but the anti-coercion measures, the efforts to support the rules-based order, other initiatives such as to do with climate change, to do with health and vaccines, as well as support for the Global South, a phrase, by the way, I'm not really crazy about, but also, for example, the undersea cable. So I think what you've seen is the G7 once again sort of returning to having a genuine role in the international system instead of it just kind of being a bunch of, you know, older men getting and some, very few women getting together and remind themselves of how important they used to be.
Mm. Well, the joint statement expressed strong criticism and concern over actions taken by Russia and China. And this, in turn, has triggered critical responses from both Moscow and Beijing, starting with the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson. He accused the G7 countries of interfering in China's internal affairs. Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, lashed out against the G7 gathering, saying that the decisions taken by the G7 are aimed at the double containment of Russia and China. Professor Kelly, what do you expect now from China and Russia? What kind of actions do you think they could take following this year's G7 summit?
Not a whole lot. I will start with China because that's the more important one. I mean, the Chinese economy is still deeply interwoven with the West, still needs access to Western banking. Western markets, you know, it participates in various international organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, where at least some kind of roughly cooperative relationship with the West is required. If the Chinese really sort of break with the West over Taiwan or Ukraine or Russia or whatever, right, it has real costs. I would argue that those costs will be asymmetric and greater for the Chinese than they would be for us. I think this explains one of the reasons why the Chinese have been so hedging on the Ukraine war, because they're really afraid of sort of burning, you know, the most important export market, which they still really need, right? I mean, China is, in terms of GDP per capita, China is still probably at least three decades behind the states that it really wants to compete against in the West. So that's, I think that explains the Chinese reticence. I mean, they'll talk a lot, right? The Chinese are sort of good at talk, and they'll bully smaller states in the region, right, in Southeast Asia and stuff like that. But I don't actually think you'll see much movement on that. I think the Russians, of course, would like to do a great deal more, right? But, I mean, Russia, quite honestly, is just too weak, right? It's under sanction. Right. Its economy is fairly corrupt at this point. It doesn't really export a great deal. It's sort of being driven really back, you know, sort of into sort of under China's wing. It's increasingly, I would argue, becoming sort of like a junior partner in the relationship with Russia. And also, I think, and with China and in time, quite honestly, might also become so with India if Russia really gets excluded because of the war. So, you know, Putin will say a great deal and, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, he'll talk and stuff like that. And maybe he'll sort of, you know, stamp its feet about nuclear weapons like he likes to do. But again, I don't think that will really go anywhere. I don't really think it will help Russia in any way to, like, change the war. I don't think, you know, Russia's basically caught in a quagmire. It's not clear to me how they can win. It's not really clear to me, like, what kind of language they could deploy that would sort of, like, reframe things. I mean, they're still stuck in the mud, if you will. And I don't think, you know, complaining about the G7 will really change that.
Mm. Professor Glossman, would you agree that there's not a lot that China and Russia will do or can do in response?
Absolutely. I think Robert pretty much nailed it. The only thing I think they also have to be careful about is not antagonizing other countries that are somewhere, if you will, on the fence, and not demonstrating a petulance or taking the steps that show and make better the West's or in the G7's case, that these are two revisionist disrupting countries. And so I think they've got to be very careful about not, if you will, confirming the negative image of them that has been presented in the over the weekend.
While the headline events over the weekend was, of course, the surprise visit by the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He took center stage at the G7 summit. He met with various world leaders, including a meeting with President Yoon Suk-yeol for about half an hour. According to the presidential office, during the meeting, Yoon pledged his continued support of Kiev, specifically promising swift efforts to send demining machines and medical evacuation vehicles for the Ukrainian military. Now, Professor Kelly, what do you make of Yoon's pledge, particularly as Ukraine in the past has been asking for lethal aid, and President Yoon himself suggested at one point that it could be possible if the situation gets serious enough?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's sort of two things going on. First, you have basically the sort of conservative internationalist predilections of Yoon and his administration, which is just kind of a fancy way of saying that the Yoon people want to be sort of more out in the world and more openly aligned with democracies, right? Not, you know, not just in the West, but also around with Japan, right? And much more so than the Moon administration, which was sort of wary about that kind of stuff, wary about sort of being pulled into the West conflicts, you know, thinking about like Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff like that. And Yoon just doesn't have those kinds of concerns. I think he really sees Korea's future sort of in this larger community of democracies and stuff like that. And Yoon has made an effort repeatedly to reach out to the Europeans, and he's trying to get along with Japan and all that. So some of that is sort of, I think, domestic, just sort of change in administration. And also, I think generally there's sort of, you know, broadly in the West, I mean, there's kind of like a slow movement of opinion, right, to sort of see that this thing is going to take a long time, and the Russians are pretty savage in the way they're prosecuting the conflict, right? I mean, Yoon has said this, right, that if there's like some big, terrible, you know, human rights event, you know, some great sort of, you know, catastrophe in Ukraine that might sort of push the South Koreans into the conflict and into lethal aid. And this has been a problem, right? I mean, you know, Putin has been really, really aggressive in the conflict, and this has undercut people in the West like Donald Trump, who would like to take a more sort of standoffish approach or even pull the plug on Ukraine. You know, every time you talk like that, the Russians go off and, you know, bombard some, you know, apartment block and kill grandmothers and kids and stuff like that. And so I think what Yoon's comments also reflect is a kind of general sense that the Russians really are the bad guys in this, right? The Russians really are the antagonists, because particularly because of the way they've prosecuted the conflict has been so very harsh, and we see that on TV on a regular basis. So that's what I think Yoon is really reflecting, right, both on his own shifts and also shifts in the South Korean population.
Mm. How do you think Yoon's promise of assistance, further assistance, will affect South Korea's relations with Russia? And what's your general assessment of the way the Yoon administration has been walking this line with supporting Russia while at the same time trying to maintain somehow relations with Moscow?
Sure. So I think the Moon administration is sort of a good place to start from, right? I mean, there's a sense, I think, when Moon was president that, you know, we need Russia to help us with North Korea, and we have this sort of export relationship. But, you know, the export relationship is fairly thin, and I would argue that Russia's not been very helpful on North Korea negotiations. And there's a little bit of a facility role back during the six-party talks, but, you know, that was like 15 years ago. And Putin has increasingly, I think, been willing to use North Korea as a spoiler against the United States. We know that North Korean illicit monies have been sort of increasingly flowing to Russian banks because, you know, American sanctions have been sort of increasingly poking around Chinese banks. So it's not clear to me. I think the Yoon people basically see that. They're like, you know, the Russians aren't really that helpful. Russian power in East Asia is weak. The trade relationship isn't really very important, right? If we don't sort of like help Ukraine a little bit more, we're kind of sending the wrong signals to the West, and we need the West's help if we get into a conflict with North Korea. And I think Yoon is kind of seeing what I think a lot of other analysts are seeing, which is that South Korea and countries like the Philippines and so on, Australia, Indonesia, are all kind of like coming up on a decision fork, right, where the Russians and the Chinese really are beginning to exhibit behavior that's pretty scary, the sort of revisionism that Brad was talking about. And countries in the middle, like South Korea, are being forced to make a choice. And Yoon is much more comfortable making that choice than Moon, who was kind of trying to sort of walk between the raindrops. And, you know, and he got himself into some trouble. You may recall that, you know, your listeners may recall that the Americans actually twisted the arm of Moon a little bit to get behind the sanctions because the Moon administration initially didn't want to do it. And I think, again, that's just sort of, I think, part of Moon's larger sense that he wants to line up broadly with the West, with America, with Japan, and so on these big democracy versus autocracy issues.
Let's move on now to President Yoon's meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, which was, of course, closely watched. They had their third meeting in just 2 months on Sunday. The talks began inside the city's Peace Memorial Park after the leaders jointly paid respects in front of a cenotaph that honoured the Korean victims of the 1945 atomic bombing in the city. Yoon said the historic visit is expected to deliver a commemoration for the Korean victims while being remembered as an act of courage by Kishida for the two sides' peaceful future. Professor Glosserman, what did you read into this visit? What does it indicate on how historical issues between the two countries will be dealt with?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of related threads here. I mean, first of all, in the general sense, the idea that we've had, as you said, the three meetings in such a short period of time, I think speaks to the desire on both governments, and particularly, let's be honest, of that in Seoul, to really move this relationship forward, to put a floor on the troubles and to start looking towards the future. And I think President Yoon deserves a great deal of credit for the courage and the boldness that he's exercised and exhibited to do that. And I think, you know, the Japanese and Prime Minister Kishida have been ready to respond. But again, as I've told your listeners before, I would prefer to see them moving more adroitly, a little more quickly, yeah, appearing to be a little less reluctant in the gestures and more leaning forward a little bit more. In the specifics of the visit to Hiroshima, I think what needs to be recognized is how deeply felt the nuclear sentiment is in Japan. So for the readiness of the Prime Minister to stand with the President at the cenotaph itself, I think is a very, very endearing and very important statement of solidarity, of an understanding of victimhood that the South Koreans have, refracted, of course, through the Japanese experience. But nevertheless, the degree to which the Japanese take that and to which they see that moment in 1945, or those two moments in 1945, as being so integral to their identity and trying to both share that. I mean, what they've been doing, I think, to the rest of the world when they brought them to the monument was to show them that moment in Japan and what it means to them, and to use that, of course, as a springboard for policy statements. But to stand there with the South Korean president and to acknowledge the victimness of the South Korean people at that moment as well is to bring the two together in a fundamental shared way. And I think, you know, it's difficult, I think, not to appreciate that. And it's very important that we understand how deeply that goes into the Japanese psyche.
Mm. Professor Glosserman, despite this visit to the monument, there was reportedly no particular mention of colonial era issues, such as the Japanese wartime forced labor issue during the summit that they held afterwards. In the summit, they did agree on the need for future cooperation on global issues and economic security. But for critics of President Yoon, they have pointed that to the fact that there was no particular mention of colonial era issues, even though many of the victims of the Hiroshima bombing would have been wartime forced labor as well. What do you make of that criticism as well?
Well, the criticism is evergreen, and you're always going to have, I think, South Koreans that are both troubled by, you know, the political stance of the Yoon administration and troubled by the Japanese way it deals with history. They're always going to be complaining about that. And there is some justification there. Japanese who say, no matter what happens, we must always be prepared to start our conversations with an apology. I think in this particular case, again, the joint appearance at the cenotaph goes a long way. The fact that they had met just so recently and that they've been putting the history issues so front and center in their relationship, as understandably it has to be. I think in this particular moment, the G7 agenda is looking at broader sets of global issues. And so at this point, I'm not that dismayed in the totality of the images and the sentiments that are being put forward over the course of the weekend. You know, again, one could say that this really, you know, none of those meetings are really about Japan and its bilateral, but they're all context framed within the context of a larger global engagement. So the next time I would anticipate the president, the prime minister would meet, it would once again assume a higher prominence on the agenda.
Professor Kelly, what did you make of the summit between Yoon and Kishida and also their visit to the monument?
Yeah, it's great, right? I mean, trilateralism is good, right? We need this, right? And it's good that the Yoon administration is willing to take some steps forward. Like Brad said, I really do wish the Japanese side would come forward and, like you said, be a little bit less grudging about it. I think Yoon's going to need something in order to sell rapprochement with the Japanese at home to the South Korean public, which is sort of really, really wary about this. And I wish Kishida would give him something a little bit more meaningful that Yoon can use to defend this policy here in South Korea, because I have the feeling that if the South Korean left wins the presidency next time, that this will end, right? I think South Koreans is, I've said this before on your show, that South Korea is very deeply divided domestically on how to respond to Japan. You know, when the presidency shifts from left to right, you know, it's like South Korean policy makes these huge swings vis-a-vis Japan and North Korea. And so I don't know if Yoon's diplomacy will survive a partisan transition in South Korea unless Kishida gives him more. That's my big concern going forward. But the symbolism is really good. Like Brett said, it really means a lot for the Japanese. It's great. It actually looks like, you know, Yoon has sort of shown some sympathy for the Japanese who died in the conflict, which is great too, right? And so it's exactly the kind of stuff that we need to sort of like begin to move beyond the history issues and actually turn toward the strategic issues. That's something that, you know, for the American side has been a really, really important thing, right? I mean, the more China gets bigger, right, the more the North Koreans build, the more the Americans are going to want it, their allies in the region to focus on the strategic issues, not on the history issues. And I'm pretty sure the Biden people were behind the scenes sort of sticking prods into both sides, telling them, you know, we got to move on because, you know, the North Koreans are, you know, building 10 nuclear weapons a year. Mm. And so I have the feeling that that's it's sort of a mix of that. It's both the geopolitics and the genuine willingness to move on.
Meanwhile, there was also a very brief meeting with Yoon, Kishida and U.S. President Joe Biden, reportedly just around a couple of minutes. But in that time, they reportedly agreed to advance their cooperation to a new level and reinforce strategic cooperation among the three nations in order to enhance deterrence against North Korea. Biden also reportedly proposed inviting Yoon and Kishida to Washington for a trilateral summit. Professor, what do you make of their brief meeting? And what could the new level in their cooperation that they mentioned be referring to?
Me or Brett?
Professor Kelly, sorry.
Probably the most important thing would be, the most immediate step would be GSOMIA, right? General Security of Military Information Agreement. That's something the Americans really wanted for a long time. Sharing information on North Korean missile launches, telemetry, and the rest is really, really important. Sharing South Korean human intelligence from defectors and so on with the Americans and the Japanese is really valuable. The more that gets institutionalized, the better deterrence of North Korea is, because we understand North Korea better and you know, we can, you know, provide more accurate information about its testing, particularly. The trilateral summit in Washington, D.C., yeah, again, that would be pretty fantastic. That would be a great symbol. That would be a great signal to the North Koreans and to the Chinese that the more they push and push and push, right, you know, on Taiwan or with the reckless WMD program in North Korea, the more there will be real costs. I mean, this is, I think, one of the problems of the last few years, right, with both the Moon administration and with the Trump administration, that it looked like North Korean behavior wasn't actually, there was no cost to it, right? And I think, you know, China sort of enjoyed the fact that South Korea and Japan weren't getting along terribly well. It gave it room to move. And so the more there's sort of like united front, the more it looks like, you know, if the Chinese don't reel North Korea in, for example, they're going to face cost, which is, you know, radar coordination in Northeast Asia among the allies. I mean, this is what we need to signal, particularly to the Chinese, right, that if you don't rein in the North Koreans, then we will be forced to increasingly cooperate on things like missile defense and military information. And the summit in Washington would be a part of that larger pushback project.
And Professor Glossman, what do you make of the trilateral summit, well, the trilateral talks that they had in Hiroshima? And what do you, when do you think the trilateral summit that Biden proposed will take place? I guess also, perhaps more importantly, what do you think will be on the agenda? Because there's been a lot of talk about how Japan could be brought into this new nuclear consultative group being set up between Seoul and Washington. Or they might even be proposing a new group with all three parties involved. What do we know so far on that front?
Well, first of all, you know, the original language you used when you addressed Professor Kelly about moving the relationship forward, I mean, of course that's what they're going to say. You're never going to say, well, we're going to rest with where we are, or particularly as we start to break ground and develop momentum, everybody's going to keep pushing to do more and more. So be careful about being overtaken by diplomatic enthusiasm. That'd be number one. Number two, I would expect that if a meeting takes place, the obvious way to do it, considering that it's almost the end of May already, is something around the UN General Assembly in September. That's when usually the leaders are in the neighborhood. So that might be the place. So whether that's a Washington meeting or a New York meeting is another matter. What would I put on the agenda? Of course, the nuclear deterrence issues, and particularly the ones that Robert mentioned in regard to straightening, if you will, or strengthening the spine of the three countries when addressing China. So the military information sharing, the deterrence and nuclear discussions. I might expect some more coordination on supply chains, on technology controls, on defense industrial cooperation, perhaps.
but certainly also trying to get together, I think, following up on the larger issues of anti-coercion, which was also mentioned at the G7. And quite frankly, I think we're all going to see a lot of discussion about artificial intelligence, which would be folded in various ways into the technology and high-tech package. But that's going to be a feature of virtually every conversation. So, I mean, you know, deterrence, technology, supply chains, those are all going to be evergreen subjects and things that governments will always be addressing whenever you have top-level discussions.
Right. Any thoughts, though, on the NCG about Japan being brought into that, the nuclear consulting group?
Well, certainly the Japanese are going to be pressing for nuclear engagement, and they've been watching closely what happens with South Korea. I think we've got to be very careful about what ultimately that NCG or whatever we're going to call it actually does. And I think there's far more smoke than there is fire in this. And there's a lot of misapprehension about what, for example, NATO does in the forms of nuclear sharing and what that means for this particular body. But to the degree that there are conversations, shared three-way conversations about the need to address deterrence and nuclear deterrence and shared understandings and making sure that all three are pulling and effectuating a meaningful and responsible division of labor, then yeah, that would be a very good idea. And I mean, to be very honest with you, there have been discussions behind the scenes doing that for years, over a decade, between the three countries, and it's precisely the sensitivity of those issues that has precluded them from getting together, not only because the United States has some concerns about what it shares with nuclear partners, but also because, to be very honest, those allies have also been very reluctant to share some of their details with third parties as well. So there's a lot of concern about looking over one's shoulder in these conversations.
Right, we'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Professor Robert Kelly and Professor Brad Glosserman. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 19.29 points, or 0.76% on Monday, to close the day at 2,557.08. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, adding 10.32 points, or 1.23%, to close at 852.04. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 8.61 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,318.1 Korean won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now, Walter Lee, to bring us those stories. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hi, Jung-ho. It's always good to see you.
Okay, let's get into our stories today then. What do you have for us first?
Yeah, there are growing complaints and criticisms in Korea over restaurants and cafes writing their entire menus in English. Now, on Sunday, a post was made on an online community under the title, "I wish there was a law that says menus should be written in Korean." The writer also posted many pictures of cafe and restaurant menus that were only in English.
Yes, this is a trend that we have been seeing, and these sorts of menus are understandably becoming quite a frustrating sight, especially for certain age groups.
That's right,
such as the elderly on one end and children on the other, who might not be able to read English, or at least not comfortably.
Mm.
So why are certain establishments opting for English-only menus? What is said to be the thinking behind it?
Well, cultural critics say that the reason behind the use of English is cultural vanity. Now, according to a survey conducted by the National Institute of Korean Language in 2020, over 41% of respondents who said they used loan words or foreign languages cited being able to convey the meaning more accurately as the reason. Other reasons given include appearing competent in using specialized terms, that was around 22.9%, and feeling more sophisticated than using just Korean, which is around 15.7%.
Yes, a sort of faux sophistication if everything is written in English. We mentioned at the start how someone said that they wished there was a law that says menus should be written in Korean. Are there any related laws like that?
Well, currently, the Outdoor Advertising Act stipulates that the characters on advertisements must be displayed in Korean according to the Hangul spelling system and Korean romanization rules. If written in a foreign language, it must also have the Korean equivalent written side by side. An establishment can be subject to a fine of up to 5 million Korean won. That's around $3,800.
Right, so there is a law, but I understand that this does not apply to menus, just for advertisements and signs. So this is where the problem arises. Perhaps there will be calls for such laws in the future, but in the meantime, we'll see if it does become a more prevalent issue as well. Okay, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so with the advancement of technology, tablets and laptops have been replacing the good old pen and paper at schools. One side effect is that this is affecting younger generations' handwriting. Now, to tackle this growing concern, schools have been holding writing classes to enhance student penmanship. Last Thursday, one high school in Seoul began a Korean writing class for all its first-year students. The school says the number of students with poor handwriting has increased dramatically in recent years as they've become accustomed to using keyboards on digital devices.
Yes, this is of course a problem that's been growing in many countries over the past several years. And while there may be many reasons why this may be a concern, the most immediate for young students is that most exams around the world are still taken on paper, meaning that at least a legible handwriting is important on that front.
Yeah, that's correct. So one teacher at a middle school in Incheon said it has become increasingly difficult to read the students' handwriting, especially on tests these days. They say teachers often have to debate over the written answers during exam periods and even have to refer back to students' previous tests to check their handwriting. Meanwhile, experts say writing by hand can improve thinking skills more than using just a keyboard. Doctors say that writing by hand not only helps you to remember what you wrote better, but also helps you develop creativity and patience.
Yes, it's not just young students, of course, as well. I believe that handwriting is also a growing concern among younger adults in Korea.
That's correct. So according to the Korea Calligraphy Association, there's been an increase in students, especially those in their 20s and 30s, who are interested in learning calligraphy. Now, adults, including those that are preparing for national certifications or administrative and foreign affairs exams, are taking classes to correct their handwriting. Now, one person said they took classes to make sure they are not marked down for bad handwriting on the exams.
Yes, I probably need those lessons. My handwriting has become pretty illegible as well nowadays, but yes, it is a concerning trend. Okay, let's move on to our final trending story. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so some great news for travellers who love to travel light. Seoul Metro announced that it launched a two-way luggage delivery service on Monday. The T-Luggage service will allow same-day delivery of travel luggage between Seoul's subway stations and Incheon or Gimpo airports. Individuals are also able to use the service to store their luggage.
Okay, that sounds interesting. So how does this service work then?
So for domestic travellers, you can conveniently leave your suitcase at the subway station on your way to work. It will be delivered to the airport during the day and you can pick it up at the airport after work as you prepare to fly out. For international tourists, you can leave your luggage at the nearest eligible subway station after you check out of your hotel. You can then travel for the rest of the day, luggage-free, and pick up your bags as you prepare to depart the airport, which I think is a great idea. Mm. You can sign up for the delivery service online or in person. However, for online bookings, you must do it one day in advance.
Okay, that does sound very convenient. You don't have to lug around your luggage all day and
right.
on public transport either. For now, though, I believe that not all subway stations have been chosen for this service.
Yeah, that's correct. So you can currently use the service at Seoul Station, Hongik University Station, Myeongdong Station and Gimpo Airport Station. By mid-June, the service will be expanded to 269 lockers installed at various subway stations in the Seoul metropolitan area. The cost to store luggage ranges from 3,000 to 8,000 won, which is roughly $2 to $6, depending on the distance and time. Now, for the delivery service, it costs between 18,000 to 28,000 Korean won. That's around $13 to $21, respectively.
Okay, that's we're going to leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Walter, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
It's time now for us to get the latest updates from the world of Korean sports. It is our Monday sports roundup, and that, of course, means it's time to bring in our trusted and brilliant contributor, sports reporter Yoo Ji-ho from the Yonhap News Agency. He joins us on the line now. Ji-ho, hello, and thank you for being with us once again.
No, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we start today with some troubling news coming out of China. It involves the Korean footballer Son Jun-ho. He is an international midfielder, and he's been in detention in China over bribery charges for several days now. Local media is saying that he could be sentenced for up to 5 years. What's the latest here?
Yeah, so what we do know so far is that the Korean embassy in Beijing first confirmed early last week that Son Jun-ho, who is a midfielder for Shandong Taishan in the Chinese Super League, had been questioned by the public security officials in Liaoning province. And the Chinese Foreign Ministry later confirmed that a Korean citizen, without identifying the person, was being held in connection with a bribery case. Now, the Korean consulate in Shenyang has met with Son Jun-ho. It said there has been no infringement of Son's rights at the moment, as of now. Now, obviously, the player's safety is of utmost concern. The speculation is that he might be tied to match fixing. Shandong's former head coach, Hao Wei, is facing, apparently, match-fixing allegations, and some of his players might be tied to the case as well. And I guess this is a bit of ironic that Son Jun-ho's former coach with Jeonbuk Hyundai Motors, Choi Kang-hee, has actually taken over Shandong Taishan in Hao Wei's absence, and he ran his first training session on Thursday. Son Jun-ho was the K-League 1 MVP for Jeonbuk in 2020, a couple of years after Choi Kang-hee left. He has been playing in Shandong since 2021. He was trying to leave China at one point earlier this month, and he was detained in the airport and has been in detention ever since that point.
Yes, I'm sure the wider footballing community in Korea has been very shocked by this situation. How are they reacting? How concerned are they about his safety and these allegations against him?
Obviously very concerned. I guess the one bit of good news that we had from this was the fact that he was doing, I guess, relatively well, and there had not been any breach of his basic rights while he was being held. And the Korea Football Association has been trying to figure out what was exactly going on using their contacts at the Chinese Football Association and also the Asian Football Confederation. But apparently there are so many people at the Chinese Football Association also facing all different types of allegations that it's been hard to find any information through that channel. So even as we speak, I guess they're trying their best to really figure out what's going on as far as what charges exactly that Son Jun-ho is facing.
Right, that's the frustrating thing about this whole situation, is the lack of transparency coming from Chinese authorities. As you said, it's still unclear the exact details of what he's being charged with or suspected of doing. Hopefully we get a clearer picture soon, but yes, it is a very concerning situation indeed. Let's move on to more sporting matters now, sticking with football though. In the K-League, the first place team Ulsan Hyundai FC extended their winning streak to 6 matches, while Jeonbuk Hyundai Motors are trying to put together a run under a caretaker manager. Let's recap the weekend action in Korean football.
Sure. Well, Ulsan squeezed past the last place Suwon Samsung Blue Wings 3-2 on Sunday, with Martin Adams scoring the winner in the 85th minute with a penalty. It's the first win by Ulsan at Suwon since Hong Myung-bo became their head coach in 2021. They had 2 draws and 3 losses prior under Coach Hong. This is Ulsan's 6th consecutive victory. They now have 13-point lead over 3 clubs right behind them: FC Seoul, Jeju United, and Pohang Steelers, all of whom had a draw over the weekend. Now, with Jeonbuk, they climbed to 7th place by defeating Suwon FC 3-1. So they've got 2 wins and 2 draws under caretaker manager Kim Doo-hyun. And key attackers Cho Kyu-sung and Song Min-kyu returned from injuries in this game. And Song broke the 1-1 deadlock 8 minutes into the second half, and that proved to be the difference in this match. So Jeonbuk trying to make things a little more interesting in the middle of the table. They've got 18 points, 3 out of the top 5 position after 14 matches.
Okay, let's turn to KBO baseball next. The SSG Landers took the three-game series against the Lotte Giants over the weekend to stay in first place. But the LG Twins now have the identical record at the top. So it's very tight indeed, which makes it pretty exciting that these two rivals will meet for three games this week. So, Jihoo, can you set up for us?
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty exciting series indeed between the two best teams in the KBO right now. So two of the three games between the Landers and the Lotte Giants at Sajik Stadium sold out in Busan. The Giants even briefly moved into first place by taking the first game on Friday, but then the Landers came back to win the next two. So their record right now is sitting at 26-14-1 in the wins and losses and ties. Now, the Twins had two wins and a tie versus the Hanwha Eagles at home, so they've got the exact same record as the Landers after giving up only three runs in those three games against the Eagles. So the Landers, right, starting Tuesday, will host the Twins for three games, but they will not have their top two starting pitchers, Kirk McCarty and Kim Kwang-hyun. They're not going to be available because they just pitched on Sunday and Saturday. So LG Twins getting a bit of a luck of the draw there. But instead for the Landers, their new foreign pitcher, Ruanis Elias, will make his KBO debut on Wednesday. For the Twins, Casey Kelly is in line to start Thursday. He's pitched a lot better of late after a shaky start to the season. He's 3-0 with a 2.14 ERA in three starts this month. After almost a 6 ERA in April, he walked 11 batters in 35 innings last month, but just one walk in 21 innings so far this month.
Okay, let's swiftly move on to some off-season basketball news. In the Korean Basketball League, the former MVP Choi Jun-yong has switched teams in free agency. He left the SK Knights to sign with the KCC Aegis. Can you give us more details?
Yeah, Choi Jun-yong signed for 5 years. He's going to make 600 million won in salary and incentives in his first season. He's the former number two overall pick in the draft. Had the Knights win the regular season title in 2022, winning their regular season MVP, putting up almost 16 points and 6 rebounds in the playoffs that year as well for the championship run. But this year, the Knights lost to Anyang KGC in the final, with Choi Jun-yong not available with the left heel injury. So he would have made a difference, I think, for that team. And also he missed the early portions of the regular season with a foot injury, ended up playing just 26 games, just about half the season. But the KCC Aegis are counting on the versatile forward to bring some scoring, also rebounding skills. You know, they got swept by the Knights in the playoffs this spring, and hoping that Choi Jun-yong can turn the tables this time around. They already have some all-star caliber players like Ho Woong, Lee Sing-hyun, and also Lee Gun-hwan, actually, who was born and recorded at Ratliff in the U.S. And plus, they're going to have 2021 MVP Song Kyu-chang back from the military service during the upcoming season. So pretty stacked roster there for the Aegis. And this has been a very busy offseason in the KBL. The playoff MVP Oh Se-geun also switched teams. He left Anyang KGC to join the Knights. And former KGC star Moon Sung-gon is now with the KT Sonic Boom. So also another former KT player, Yang Hong-seok, is now with the LG Sakers. So a lot of movement between some top names in the KBL this offseason.
Indeed. And finally, the smiling high jumper is back. Woo Sang-yuk grabbed his first international title of the season on Sunday in Japan and made a bit of a Korean athletics history in the process, I understand. Jihoo, can you tell us more?
Yeah, Woo Sang-yeon won the high jump title at the Seiko Golden Grand Prix in Yokohama by clearing 2.29 meters. Joel Baden of Australia also jumped 2.29 meters, but he needed two attempts. Woo only needed one attempt to do so. So Woo Sang-yeon is the first Korean athlete to win a gold medal at a Golden Grand Prix event on the World Athletics Continental Tour Gold Circuit. So this is right below the Diamond League as far as the prestige is concerned. Pretty significant, milestone for Woo, who's got a lot of firsts, I guess, for Korean athletes. Last year, he became the first Korean to win a Diamond League title and also to win a World Indoor Gold Medal and then finish second at the World Outdoor Championship last year, the best showing by a Korean athlete. So, he raised the bar at some point to 2.29 meters, jumped over in one attempt. He went for 2.32 meters, you know, failed in all three tries.
Mm.
And Biden went for 2.35, failed in all three tries as well. Slightly off his personal best, obviously, for Woo Sang-yeok, still early in the season. His next competition will be in Italy for the Diamond League on June 2nd.
Okay, that's all for our roundup this week. Jiho, we appreciate it as always. Have a great week and we'll speak to you again soon.
Okay, you too. Thanks for having me.
Did you enjoy this segment? You can discover more segments like this throughout the week on Korea 24. On Monday, we bring you news from the world of sports around the peninsula. Then on Tuesday, notable guests from various fields join us and give us insight into their lives and work. Are you a fan of books? Then tune in on Wednesday for Korea Book Club, where our book critic helps us unpack works by Korean authors or written on Korea. Go on an adventure with us every Thursday as we take a look at Korea's hidden gems with Explore Korea. And on Friday, listen to what our film critics have to say about the latest movie releases from both home and abroad. We have all that you need, all in one place, on Korea 24.
We've come to our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview. This is where we take a look at some interesting features, reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And for that, our staff editor, Richard Larkin, has joined us in the studio once again. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jango.
So just one story today, I believe.
Yes.
And let's get into it. What have you brought for us?
I have chosen Park Ga-young's article in the culture section of the Korea Herald. It's about an adaptation of William Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice, which has an interesting twist. That's because next month in Seoul, the play will be performed in the style of Changguk.
Okay, interesting. Can you explain for our listeners what Changguk is exactly?
Sure. It is a traditional Korean opera performed with pansori, a form of Korean musical storytelling that involves a singer and a drummer on stage. The National Changguk Company of Korea has created this adaptation with the award-winning playwright Kim Eun-sung. The story follows a merchant in Venice named Antonio who defaults on a large loan provided by a moneylender. The article mentions that this is the first traditional comedy that the company will perform. Previously, it has tried traditional pansori performances, Greek tragedies, and even webtoons.
Okay, interesting. So a sort of eat meets West reimagining of sorts of Shakespeare's works.
Yes.
You mentioned that the performances will be held next month in Seoul. Can you tell us more about that?
The Merchant of Venice will be performed from June 8th to the 11th at Haeoreum Grand Theatre. It's located at the National Theatre of Korea. Ticket prices range from 20,000 to 80,000 Korean won. That's between 15 and 60 US dollars. And the good news is that the performances will have English subtitles.
Yes, very useful for expats here.
Yes. And also keep an eye out for future performances by this company. That's because it aims to create productions rooted in Korea's own culture and identity, and also create renditions of universal stories. So there may be interesting adaptations of some well-known stories in the future.
Okay, so there's perhaps some more to look forward to in the future as well.
Yes.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us that story, Richard, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
And that's where we call it a day for our show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. So we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio offers all you need to know on Korea through its various programs. Tune in to One Fine Day with Lena Park and join the K-pop diva for 2 fine hours every weekday. Are you into the latest K-pop tracks? Then K-pop Connection is your fix. Brian Ju brings you the best of K-pop and K-culture. On Korea 24, host Kwon Jang-ho helps listeners digest all the biggest stories coming out of South Korea. Keep up with what's happening on the peninsula by listening to Korea 24. Learn about Korean folktales on Mondays with Global Audiobook, Once Upon a Time in Korea. If you're a bookworm, don't miss Books on Demand, a program that introduces Korean literature to the global audience every Tuesday. Our Wednesday program, Korea Today and Tomorrow, provides news on the latest diplomatic developments in and around the Korean peninsula. Want to go deeper than K-pop? Sounds of Korea takes a closer look at various traditional music every Thursday. KBS World Radio is your go-to channel for all things Korea. Tune in